There is a secret that most pro athletes, elite CEOs, and high performers all know. They all have a group of world-class coaches working for them to help them optimize their potential. At Super Athlete Radio, our goal is to provide you with the caliber of world-class coaches and guests to help you unlock your potential, dominate your industry, and dominate your life. Let's get better today. Welcome to Super Athlete Radio. Really excited to bring on Director of Sports Science, Eric Renahan from the University of Miami to Super Athlete today. How are you?
Great. Thanks for having me.
Really excited to have you on, Eric. And before we get into what you're doing at University of Miami, I'd love to hear a little bit about how you got into the human performance industry.
Yeah. So I guess it dates back to my time as an athlete. I played sports in high school, growing up in California, did a lot of extracurricular activities, outside of team sports, and then went to university, had an opportunity to play soccer in college. And I guess at that point was probably a little bit more interested in things that weren't related to soccer and probably, affected my career longevity at that point. But was super into training, and I think that was where I really grew to love kind of the thing that was most important to me for the collegiate athletics part of my career was the training aspect, but not necessarily the playing. Mm-hmm. So much. And at that point, I had an opportunity once I graduated with my kinesiology degree to become a strength coach and move into the field that I really was kind of interested in. Being in the Bay Area, had a lot of people to network with, moved on from the collegiate sector at that point to work at a private sector facility called Sparta Performance Science for a couple of years.
Very familiar.
And then was fortunate to move into the NHL. I met Mike Potenza through that networking, in the San Jose area. Got into an assistant position with Mike, and then moved my way through the NHL for about 10 seasons. And then at the end of my last season in St. Louis, kind of thought I needed to, be a little bit more of a dad reduce some of my time spent working. And so we moved back to California for about a year and then got an opportunity to come to UM and be the director of sports science. So it's my going into my third year here now. So I'm really excited of what we've been able to do so far and what we're able to build out. So
that's awesome. And how old are your kids now?
So we have a 13-year-old and an 8-year-old.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then you mentioned that when you were in college, what kind of shifted for you was how much you enjoyed just the training piece. Could you elaborate a little bit more on that and like what specifically really kind of felt like was calling you?
Yeah, I think I had always been exposed to training. My dad was really into working out and running and training. And so I had always been exposed to that as a kid. And, when I got to college, I knew I wanted to do something. I thought I wanted to be a physical therapist. When I was going into college and then I experienced strength and conditioning and was really able to see what the difference was between physical therapy and strength and conditioning. And that was really what I wanted to do. Once I was exposed to it, I kind of knew, all right, I want to be a PT doing stuff with injured people as much as I want to be working with athletes. And so, again, being a college kid, I probably didn't spend as much time on focusing on the sport as I should have. But when I was in the weight room and when I was exposed to the stuff that we were doing with our strength coaches, I was really into it. And I think that's where, at that time, San Jose State had a really good kinesiology program for the undergrads. Mm. And, I took advantage of that. And I think that's where my interest really kind of grew with some of the stuff that they were teaching us on the applied side, how to monitor and measure different things, as well as kind of the principles of strength and conditioning. And so at that point, I really kind of focused on wanting to be a performance coach and then moving, from schooling into Sparta, I was exposed to technology at a pretty granular level there. And that's where I think my love for, the sports sciences really kind of blossomed.
And when it comes to tracking and measuring things, now that we'll go into the sports science piece in a little bit, but why do you feel like that's so important for people to do in terms of, let's start with just in terms of fitness?
Yeah, I mean, I think across the board, if we can monitor and measure everything that we're doing, we know what's working and we know what's not working, and it allows us to be better at doing less. And I think from the kind of the perspective that I have as a sports scientist, if we can get better at doing less things and know what works, we can eliminate the things that don't work. And particularly with where we're at now at the U, we have a limitation on time that we can spend with our athletes at different points of the year. And so if we can get by with doing highly effective things that take less of our time, it I think creates a little bit less load overall for the athletes, and it gets us in and out of the building a little bit more effectively as well. So I think monitoring, measuring, I think for us, it's really been become part of what we just, what our culture is. It's just how we do things, and less about having testing days and separating specific segments of our off season or in season to do maybe certain data collection processes. So it's really been part of just how we operate now.
And then for people who are walking in, who train, but they're not really tracking and measuring their training, maybe they feel like it's overwhelming to them. Do you have any advice in terms of what they can do to be able to take that step? Because it sounds like it's going to save time in the long run.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think the biggest piece of advice I can give is to find the lowest hanging fruit that you can. Mm. You know, if you're not sleeping well at night, or you don't feel like you're eating the right foods, figure out what that thing is, and then find a simple way to maybe measure 1 to 3 different things related to that aspect of what you feel like is kind of the best opportunity for you to get better at that point. And I think if most people start with 1 or 2 things, it's easier to kind of stay on top of those things. And, you can measure them in multiple ways and depending on what you're trying to do. And then once you get really consistent with that, you can then bump it up to maybe another thing that we're going to measure, or, 3 or 4 aspects of that aspect of your performance or your health and fitness that you're trying to improve. So I think starting small and really going after one thing, getting consistent and really focusing on that is probably the biggest piece of advice I can give.
Yeah, I think that's super helpful. And I love that because, in elite sports, they talk about like marginal gains and getting 1% better every day. But in my experience, for a lot of people, they have like a 20% thing that's just kind of sitting out there. Right. So if they get that, I mean, this is, high performers as well. But if they get that squared away, then performance dramatically improves. And in your time with in the NHL, was there anything that kind of stood out to you in terms of maybe specific measurables that really translated over to performance?
I mean, I think at that level, you're dealing with some highly skilled dudes, and they're at that level for a specific reason. And, a lot of the things that, might seem interesting to us as performance coaches or sports science guys is, let's try this and see what we can get. But, you have to figure out at some point, you don't want to mess with these guys. And if you do, you might make them, not perform as well as they could have, or why that, take away some of the things that make them special. I think for me, the biggest area that we were able to improve our guys just, in St. Louis specifically was nutrition. Mm-hmm. And understanding kind of what that individual guy needed, as opposed to just kind of blanket training and blanket prescriptions of nutrition and supplementation, really trying to figure out what do you need specifically and can we deliver that to you. And I think for our guys, nutrition, restoration, recovery, those are the biggest bang for our buck modalities that we were able to really kind of support them with. Everyone trains, everybody does their mobility, everybody does their different things that they do to prep themselves for the game. But really, it was those more kind of internal characteristics that we were able to help them with. And I think that was, a big factor into why we were ready to play a very long season in 2019.
And then what was your guys' process to kind of individualize their nutrition?
Yeah, I mean, I think for us, it was at first, let's try to improve just the quality of the food that we're getting. Where are we getting the food? What kind of food are we getting? I think that was, like I said, lowest hanging fruit for us was, can we fix that? Mm-hmm. And then two, we wanted to integrate biomarker analysis. So really look at, what's happening within the body. Can we check the oil, so to speak, and see where we can make adjustments to maybe maintaining the baselines that you have and, you're healthy and you're feeling good? Or are there areas that you might be lacking in that we can supplement and improve those? And so that for us was, that the first thing, nutrition, just let's get better food quality and enhance that. And then two, can we see what's really going on inside of you and address that?
And then how often were you guys doing blood work?
It depended. We had a couple times of year where it was team-wide. Mm-hmm. And then as more and more players were starting to kind of feel better and buy into it, we would have individually periodic blood draws for them. One of the companies that we used at that time was Inside Tracker, because it was easy for us to go to Quest and get a blood draw. And at the end of my time in St. Louis, I had probably about 11 guys doing relatively consistent, maybe every month if we were able to, or maybe every 90 days or so mm-hmm. on their own. And so at that point, it was really probably, I think one of the best outcomes that we could have gotten was, you know, instead of forcing them to do it, we had guys asked to do it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that was, they just, in terms of just how they felt day to day, it felt,
yeah,
I mean, or was there like, had more additional evidence?
I mean, I think, you know, we can see objectively that we were improving, you know, vitamin D level, reducing C-reactive protein and in some of these biomarkers that we can pull, but just subjectively and anecdotally, you know, guys were feeling a little bit fresher. They didn't feel as run down at the end of the season. When we made our push into the playoffs that year and we had a very deep run into the playoffs, I think we played, I think we played 26 out of 28 possible playoff games. And in that year we had the, I think we had 11 preseason games. So I mean, we played a pretty dense season that year in terms of total games. And for us at that point, our best players had to be our best players and they had to be on the ice. And so load management really wasn't an option in terms of like, let's not play you as much. Mm-hmm. For us, load management came down to, can we keep you feeling good and keep you fresh and recovering as opposed to maybe pulling back on a lot of different things. And part of that was because our team was a very, you know, heavy practice team.
Okay.
So we had to figure out ways. We're not going to be able to just take the day off. So can we do other things to enhance your recovery and reduce that kind of burnout effect that we might see if we weren't doing this?
And then what were some of the modalities in recovery that you found to be really effective in your time in St. Louis?
I mean, there's different things like topical EMG stimulation, STEM, different kind of things that you would normally see. I realized that my biggest bang for my buck as a coach at that point was going to be able to provide these guys with things that they may not have or may not have experienced elsewhere. So one of those things.
Novelty.
Yeah, exactly. You got to keep them excited, yeah. Right? So for me, I think red light, infrared, near infrared light, that was a big thing. We had some guys that were interested in grounding. So we had some biomats that we were using. We had a Kangen water filter that we installed. So all of the shakes that I was making for the guys, anything that was pre-game based drinks or any of that was used. We were using Kangen water filters for that. Other things that were valuable to us were sauna. So mm-hmm. we're using just normal traditional Finnish saunas. And that came into to be very valuable for us in ways that I didn't think were necessarily going to impact our guys. And one of those ways was really kind of looking at how much sympathetic tone guys were having. Mm-hmm. Just anecdotally and subjectively during warmups, if they were overexcited, you know, we had a guy that maybe it took him, you know, 4 or 5 shifts to, you know, start the game on time, right? He would be too excited. He couldn't calm himself down. So, you know, we shifted his warmup instead of doing things that were a little bit more ballistic and, you know, things that you would traditionally see guys doing. We actually went in the sauna and had him go in the sauna and did some breathing techniques and it actually calmed him down a little bit to the point where he was actually starting the game on time. Mm-hmm. And so those different types of I think tricks and modalities were really helpful. And in 2019, I saw an article somewhere that someone was talking about using essential oils for different things. Mm-hmm. And we mm-hmm. started using essential oils. Mm-hmm. You know, after a loss, I would, you know, change the oil in the morning to lemon and get guys a little bit more kind of amped up to come in.
I love that.
Yeah. So we were using, I was trying to do anything we could, right?
Yeah.
But I think those kind of different like tricks and things that you might not normally expect to be happening at the NHL level or, you know, in some of these pro teams. I was trying anything we could, really.
And then we talked about this before on the show about how some high level athletes, people in general, some people, they do better in terms of getting themselves really excited and hyped up to perform, and others do better in more of a calm state. So when the player you referenced, who you said was more, you used the term sympathetic.
Yeah. I mean, I at that point I thought, you know, you're just overexcited, right? You know, we did some internal load things at that point, you know, but from that point to where I'm at now, I mean, I didn't really grasp that concept as sympathetic mm-hmm. tone as much as I probably should have. Mm-hmm. But I would just say at that point, you know, I'm like, you're way too amped up. Mm-hmm. We got to calm you down a little bit. And, mm-hmm. You know, looking back, it was, you know, a lot of sympathetic tone this guy was living in. It was a little bit of a kind of an anxiety response, you know, higher respiration rates, all these different things that you can see happening. And then you watch the game and then you're like, oh my gosh, this guy can't get going until he actually plays a few shifts and then calms down. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I mean, looking back, you know, a massive kind of cognitive stressor, you know, creating that sympathetic response and, you know, trying to figure out like how am I going to help this guy in sauna. It was, you know, guys always felt calm coming out of there, and you know heart rate actually comes down, and so I was like, well, why don't we try this and see if that helps, and he loved it.
And then were there specific ways you were measuring to see how well people were recovering?
We used First Beat.
Okay.
When I was with the Blues. So First Beat's a system. I think it's they branched off of Sumto at some point. They're based out of Finland. We use that pretty extensively. I had used that my entire NHL career. So for at that point, I was in year 8 measuring with First Beat. So we were doing the quick recovery test. We were doing things that we were looking at both off the ice and on the ice. I think that was probably the thing that I was able to use most objectively to identify some of those responses in, you know, that would classify as internal load.
Mm-hmm.
We're doing a lot of force plates and I, you know, but again, I had about 11 to 12 guys at the end of my time in St. Louis jumping on game days to see how we needed to tweak their warm up.
Mm-hmm.
You know, cause the buy-in was there and they saw that, you know, this wasn't something that was going to either say you were ready or not ready to play. You're going to play. What can we do to make you feel better about playing?
Yeah.
So, you know, at that point I was using First Beat and Hawk and Dynamic force plates to really kind of, you know, be objective at least as much as I could to figure out what I was going to do that day with a guy.
I love that frame. This is something we talk about on the show all the time of like, there's this one line of, we want to continuously getting optimize our training, our nutrition, our sleep, our recovery. And then this other line is when shit is going sideways, we can still, you know, how well can we still perform? Yep. So you said there that it's not a matter of whether you're going to play or not. It's just, what can we do to set you up to perform at your best?
Absolutely.
And then in terms of all your time in the NHL, is there anything in terms of like mindset wise that really stood out to you? Maybe a couple characteristics from really like the best of the best players compared to other players, with a couple mindset things that stood out to you?
Yeah. I mean, I think the best players, I was very fortunate in the NHL. Like at the point at which I entered the NHL, to the point at which I left, the three teams I worked for had Hall of Famers on every team. I had Patrick Marleau and Joe Thornton, Joe Pavelski in San Jose, the Sedin brothers, Kevin Bieksa in Vancouver, and then Alex Petrangelo, Jay Bomeister. And, you know, these guys were true professionals. And so, you know, what I think the simple thing that I would say I could take away from all of those guys was that things aren't always as good as they seem, and they're never as bad as they seem.
Mm.
And so with those guys, whether they played well or whether they didn't play well, things were pretty consistent with them, and how they handled those different outcomes, I think, is where we're trying to figure out how to continue to help our kids now at the U is, how do you handle failures compared to how you handle success?
Mm-hmm.
And with those guys, I mean, that message across the board was, you know, like, yeah, we won or we lost. We got 85 games to go, right, if we make the playoffs here. So let's, you know, game one, game two, loss, doesn't matter. So I think the consistency and how they handled those peaks and valleys within the season was really kind of the biggest takeaway on the, you know, the, I would say, mental performance or kind of sports psychology piece for sure.
Mm-hmm. And then how do you teach that to kids?
Well, I mean, that's the hard thing, right?
Yeah.
I think it's, you know, figuring out how they do respond. You know, can we objectively find how an athlete responds to cognitive stress, right? And I think a lot of what people are trying to do is tease out that hidden information, so to speak, that you can't necessarily measure in simple ways and figure out, is this what we're seeing, a product of too much practice, too much weight room, or is this a product of that plus stress in school, or are you not able to retain the information the way it's being presented to you in meetings and in video and film sessions? And I think a lot of that is really when you're working with the academic side and some of the athletics support staff to understand, like, does this athlete need a little bit more visual stimulus to show them what they're doing wrong, or can we give that to them in text and in their binders? And so figuring out how they retain that information is probably number one. And number two, I would think is really kind of, you know, like I mentioned earlier, is how do they handle failure?
Mm-hmm.
How do they handle success? And can we give them some strategies to be able to do that, you know, with less kind of peaks and valleys between the two?
And then I heard you mention what you were saying there about in terms of, how accepting kids were in terms of certain forms of learning and information, whether in the film room or in the binders in an interview, that you did. How are you able to tell whether someone is receiving?
Yeah, that's the hard part.
Yeah.
When I first got to Miami, there was a company, a local company called Tiger Tech.
Okay.
And, they are designed and they've been created for Department of Defense use. So they're other than us, they're operational in special operations communities and in DOD, and they're local to Miami. So I was introduced to them. They were kind of created out of Mount Sinai Medical Center as a way to monitor some different things within the special operations community. And so I met up with them, went through their technology and you know, was hitting all the marks that I needed for something to be able to start measuring internal load and doing other things at a high level here.
Mm-hmm.
So we did a little beta test with them. My first summer had 25 guys on, and then feedback from the players was great. The information that was coming out was very, very strong. And we looked at some correlations between our catapult system and some of the accelerometry data, and it was apples to apples. So we kept them through the season, my first season, and then we bumped that to 50 guys this past season.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the ways that we've been able to do this is that it has two ECG leads. So with HRV and heart rate, it's an extra little signal that we're looking to try to get that information from, as opposed to PPG, which would be like your Whoop band or your Oura ring that uses light sensors.
Mm-hmm.
So with that, we're looking at, you know, how can we see these different stressors of our athletes,
mm-hmm.
you know, practice wise, weight room wise, and then also out of the weight room. So we have them come in the morning, they wear the device, we get a 5-minute baseline, they continue to wear the device through meetings.
Mm-hmm.
And then they go into practice or lifts, and then practice depending on the day. And just like we do with catapult or any other system, we tag the different activities that they're doing at that time. So
mm-hmm.
we're able to start to segment out, you know, what are we seeing from a internal load response in the absence of physiological demand? Mm-hmm. So can we see changes in heart rate, respiration rate? There's a pulse oximeter measure or sensor built into it. And so can we see these biometric changes? And can we see that in the absence of any sort of mechanical or physiological load?
Mm-hmm.
And in those situations where we can observe that, we know that there's something creating a sympathetic response to them that's cognitive, or a response that's creating this this impact on biometrics that isn't coming from sport or training. And so now we can figure out what that source is, and then give them the intervention that they need.
And that's potentially in the case of their learning ability, is they're getting stressed because they're not.
That's kind of that's our hypothesis.
Okay.
So yeah. We don't,
that's amazing.
We don't know for sure, but you know, when we start talking to the athletes, and this is another interesting thing, is that with this, because we have an IRB open, the athletes have the right to refuse to do this. It's one of the one things that they kind of have choice on,
sure.
in college sports, right? It's a dictatorship at the best for those kids. So with this technology, because we have an IRB, we go through the whole thing with them. We have them consent to it, and then they at any point no longer want to use it, it's not a problem, no more discussion.
Mm-hmm.
So the buy-in that we have with these 50 kids is extremely high. So when we talk to them about things that we see, oh yeah, I get really nervous in film sessions because I don't like watching myself. I'd rather see it on paper, or I'd rather watch it on the iPad, or vice versa. I'd rather see it on film. I don't like reading my binder, and I don't, you know, so can we give them strategies to be able to assist with that? And then, you know, there's some kids that just the way they learn is different. And so, you know, talking to their positional coach or the coordinators on, maybe we want to present information to this kid a different way because he's going to learn it better, and he's going to be able to get into the right positions. He's going to run the right routes or so on. And so we can, you know, again, our hypothesis is that these stressors or these responses we're seeing are coming from this kind of anxiety or this inability to kind of either handle those stress, the successes or the failures that they're shown, or that they're not just retaining that information at the level at which they need to.
And then I think it is super important in terms of consistency and being able to show up the next day, whether you just won the championship or you just, you know, lost the big game or whatever it is with what happened. How big of a factor do you feel like mindset plays in terms of actual physiological response?
I mean, I think it's huge. Yeah. I mean, it's one of our, I think one of our pillars within our program. Coach Aaron Feld is a big proponent of mindset and really kind of driving that concept across the organization, but specifically with the players. And, you know, having the right mindset is critical. You know, my first year here, we were 5-7. And then, you know, this year we had a better season and a better outcome, but we're constantly trying to improve, but we're not trying to improve with the mindset that, you know, we were not good as we could have been 2 years ago. We're just looking forward. And so we're trying to get the athletes to see that, you know, the past was for learning on what we could have done better. And now we need to put that into action. And so mindset, I think, is critical. And again, going back to those examples from the NHL, it's like, you know, things aren't always as bad as they seem. And when they're good, they're not always as good as they seem. There's always different things that we can be working on. And so that's, I think, the message that we're trying to get our athletes to see.
And then from a really high level, could you describe what you, when you say internal load? How do you define that?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's one of those things that I've, over the last couple of years, I've really been able to focus on a little bit more. And I look at internal load or as a couple of things. It's kind of the physiological response. So things, you know, the cardiovascular system and how that's responding to either training or non-training stimulus. And then kind of that mental piece on, you know, the cognitive stressors. And one of the other things that we did this year that we kind of iterated from our first year with the Tiger Tech system was that on game days, we actually had guys wear it on the bus ride from the hotel to the game. So again, does that change once you leave the hotel and get on the bus and you get closer to the stadium? Can we see those spikes in respiration, heart rate, and so on? And so to us, that our hypothesis is that when we see those things, it's an excitement factor. But when we see too much of that, if it goes up too much, you know, we know that we need to do some other things to pull that back a little bit. And so internal load to me is kind of that autonomic nervous system and that sympathetic and that parasympathetic tone that our athletes live in. And you know, what we're not trying to get too sympathetic to the point where we're blunting that parasympathetic reactivation and, you know, causing multiple days of recovery time, as opposed to, you know, let's get to the right level of excitement and then we can recover well and then we can do it again tomorrow. So to me, it's just that internal response is the catalyst for what we can see when we're watching guys run. It's, you know, when we see a guy run slower or not jump as high or move differently, to me that problem now is already there. We're behind the problem. If we can use these internal metrics and we can get in front of them, we can be more proactive on reducing, you know, what we end up seeing in a game where a guy looks tired or a guy looks like he's not running or changing directions as well.
And then for those listening to this who maybe are not in high level sports, how what can they do to monitor their internal load, which of course, you know, impacts everything that we do?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think, you know, the Whoop bands, you know, the different wearable technologies, Apple Watches, all those different things. I mean, those are great just for general monitoring. And I think anybody that has access to that can start to monitor some aspect of their day, whether that's step count, whether that's heart rate or sleeping. And I think by doing that, you're already going to be ahead of a lot of people because you know what you're doing well or what you're not doing well. And then you can then tie a feeling to that. And that's where I would really kind of say with most of our guys is like, here's the data, but how did you feel? And so that they can kind of put two and two together is like, okay, when I feel like this and this is down, that's not a good thing. So when this goes up, I should feel better. And these are the things we're going to do to try to help. I think the general population, it's the same thing. And, you know, all of these different sensors have these capabilities to provide some objective information. And, you know, I think for me, that's probably the first step is just, you know, figuring like, what do you want to measure? And is it sleep? Is it, you know, how much exercise I'm getting that day? And, you know, just be consistent with that.
Figuring out what you want to measure, then being consistent. For someone who's been in high-level sports for so long, I think a very underrated aspect of what you do is the ability to communicate, especially I think now with so much of what you're doing is around data. In your time in the NHL and then now at the U, What are some strategies that you've seen from yourself and or for coaches that have really helped in terms of team building and effective communication and things like that?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, for me, it's always, I think simple is better. Mm-hmm. And when communicating information, I think to my peers, whether, you know, we're on a high level podcast or I'm talking to other strength coaches, you know, I can use a little bit more kind of a high level terminology and explain things in a little bit more scientific manner. Mm-hmm. But when I'm dealing with athletes, when I'm dealing with coaches, when I'm dealing with administrators or general managers, I need to, number one, simplify the message in a way that they can, you know, take that in. And two, I need to stay consistent across all of those stakeholders. And so when, if I explain something to an athlete, I don't change the language in which I explain to the athlete. When I change my messaging to the GM or the coach, it stays the same. Mm-hmm. And there's two reasons I kind of, you know, started to adopt that mindset was that I don't want to tell the athlete something, tell the GM something, even though it might be the same thing and use different language. And then they're like, hey, E, what's going on? Like, he told me this. And so I wanted to try to eliminate that aspect of the you know, breakdown in comms that generally happen. And two, I think keeping things as simple as possible and just, you know, that allows you to influence change a little bit more effectively as opposed to confusing people. And, you know, I think that's ultimately where I found some success in communicating our information was, you know, simple and, you know, what we're trying to get them to change is going to be by doing this. And if you don't want to do it, we probably won't see change. And then, you know, let them decide what they want to do. So that's really kind of my strategy, I guess, for communications and really trying to, again, influence change across an organization.
And is that something that you're putting a lot of thought in ahead of time to figure out how can I simplify this? Or
I think so. I mean, you know, when I'm talking to people about autonomic nervous system or the difference between the somatic nervous system and sympathetic and parasympathetic, and, you know, we're looking at rate of force development here and all these. And most of the people I'm presenting that to don't understand those concepts from the scientific perspective. But if you can simplify it in a way that they can understand it and relate it to themselves, it's way easier to get them to not only buy into what you're saying, but then for them to maybe go along with your suggestions that you're making to, you know, support the program and enhance the either recovery aspects of the athletes or the performance of the athletes. And I think when we did that, we started doing that in Vancouver when I was with the Canucks, and we started using some of the terminology and equating it to gears and brakes and you know, how cars work, because athletes all understood that concept. And then, you know, we're talking about those different things. All right, first gear is your first step and so on. And your, you know, your D cells, your brakes, and you got to be able to, you know, slow down if you're going to go fast. So those different concepts that we used, everyone kind of had a grasp of. And so it allowed us to kind of build off of that.
Yeah. And you used one of those earlier when you're talking about the blood panel, checking the oil.
Yeah, exactly. Yep.
Yeah. Do you feel with all this data now compared to like 15 years ago, do you feel like there's been a distinct upgrade in terms of athletic performance?
That's a tough one. Mm-hmm. That's a tough one.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know that with the advancements in technology that we've necessarily seen an increase in performance. I think, you know, a lot of times when there's new technologies that come out, you're collecting an abundance of data. And a lot of times you just sit on this mountain of data and don't know how to put it into action. And so I think a lot of times it can actually be a hindrance in some ways. Mm-hmm. And so I think for us, we really wanted to try to pull in data that can answer questions. Mm-hmm. And so those questions that we get asked, we need to be able to find answers to. And then, you know, I will always tell my staff that, you know, the next piece of our job is to try to answer questions that haven't been asked of us. Mm-hmm. And can we find things that are happening with our athletes that we can see already with the data that we've used to answer these questions, but then take it another step and figure out, you know, why are we still seeing guys look tired? Mm-hmm. Okay, let's figure that out. And so for us, you know, answering questions is really what we need to do, number one, and using the technology that can help us do that is number two. And I think there's lots of different things we can use. But for us, if we get caught in that mindset of let's just get as much cool stuff as we can and try to see something interesting,
yeah,
we're probably doing a disservice to our athletes.
Yeah, spinning a circle.
Yeah.
And then referencing tired and the athletes and what energy is such a huge deal with people. What do you feel like are some things people can do to improve their energy and maybe just have awareness on what's causing energy drops and what, you know, what are some things people can do to optimize their energy?
Yeah, I mean, I think I always go back to, I mean, the two biggest, you know, biggest rocks when it comes to maintaining energy is sleep and nutrition. And, you know, if you have the ability to get a blood draw and get a blood panel done and look at some of these kind of biomarkers that your body will really tell you a lot about your energy levels. When you look at some of these metrics and you see these changes or these baselines, that's number one. And then, you know, finding strategies to make it easier to sleep, to go to sleep, but to stay asleep. You know, I think a lot of athletes struggle with that. And I think a lot of people just in general, struggle with that. And, you know, like I can go to sleep, but I can't stay asleep. I wake up and I'm like, can't get back to sleep. So I need to figure out ways to do that. So for me, those are the two biggest performance enhancers that are available to us at no cost, really. And, you know, blood draws are relatively cheap now. And I think those two things combined make a massive difference, you know, in just the human being, not specifically athletes. So I think those are the two that I could recommend. Other different things like red light's a really good tool, becoming less expensive and more accessible to people to really kind of enhance your recovery effects. But also, some of these companies are adding blue light wavelengths in there, but not to the point at which it's going to actually, you know, create some of these eye problems that people are having, but to almost enhance your ability to wake up. So I think these different tools that are becoming more accessible, along with understanding just what's happening with your body itself, are probably the biggest ways that people can maintain their energy. And you know, I think that's going to trend itself into being able to monitor other things that they might want to do and, you know, get to the level at which some of these athletes are at now.
Sleep, nutrition, and then in your experience, anything have you found worked effectively for staying asleep?
Yeah, I mean, I think magnesium's, a lot of people are deficient in magnesium. And I think that plays a part in the ability to not stay asleep. Magnesium is really probably one of the biggest biomarkers that is deficient in people other than vitamin D. I think Miami, where we don't have that much of a problem, necessarily, but across the country, vitamin D levels generally are pretty low, and especially with athletes. And if magnesium levels can go up, I think it's easier to maintain that balance. Magnesium 3-nate's a good one. I take that myself. And that's a type of magnesium that helps kind of more relax the nervous system a little bit. And it, for me, once I get to sleep, it makes me, you know, stay asleep a little bit longer. So, other things, I think, you know, omegas at night, I think those are different. Those have some different impacts on the brain and kind of the recovery, kind of reducing that busy brain feeling that most people have. I'm not a huge fan of melatonin and things like that, because I want that to be more of a natural production of melatonin. So for me, I don't necessarily utilize that. But those are kind of the two that I'm kind of messing around with now, I guess, to see if I can stay asleep longer.
And then a lot of what we've been talking about today is going back, what you said the best players were doing in the NHL is just their ability to be consistent. And it's this idea of just having good rituals and routines day in and day out. What do you feel like is the best way for do you have any thoughts on like how people can track this? Like, okay, I should be taking magnesium 3-nate, make sure I take that before bed every night, you know, make sure I do this in the morning, which is going to set me up for energy. Do you have any tools or protocols that you found helpful to get people to install habits?
I mean, I think I guess there's some apps now that you can use, that people use. Like, I know Whoop has an app that you can start to journal and keep track of different things. I just simply have like pill boxes labeled for guys, and you know, like, here's your pill box, this is what time you take this, and this is how many you take, and you label it. And that was the simplest way that I was able to kind of come up with for guys to stay consistent. You know, but I think there's different things like journaling and writing it down. People that are very serious about trying to make some improvements in their health and their performance and just their longevity in life, journaling and writing things down are really important, because I think a lot of people, you know, if they're not an athlete, they don't have that that dose response of like, if I did this, did I perform today? Like, I go to work and I feel better, but you know, athletes know, did they perform well or not perform well? It's easy to kind of put success indicators on them. And so with kind of general population, I always talk about writing it down and how did I feel this day? And, you know, did I feel better than yesterday? And what did I miss? What did I not miss today in terms of my supplements or my nutrition? And did I actually work out today or did I not? And I use myself as an example because I'm not an athlete and I'm not training like an athlete. And so I try to do those things to keep myself a little bit more consistent because, you know, depending on the day, depending on what part of the season we're in, you know, my days can be 18-hour days and I forget to eat and I don't take my vitamin D or whatever it is. So I try to write that down and keep track of it. So those would be, you know, get a box, label it, write it down, you know, check in at the end of the day on how you felt. Those are kind of things that I'm doing and they seem to keep me a little bit more consistent.
And then how do you feel like, do you have any thoughts or ideas when things are not going well and you haven't been taking your stuff or just life happens in terms of adversity? How do you personally deal with that in terms of showing up every day for your kids and for the team and for the university?
Yeah, that's a tough one, you know, because you have your why. Everyone has a why in terms of what they're doing and why they, you know, they take the job they take or the things that they do. And for me, it is that group of people, is my family and it's my peers and the athletes. And you know, I was given a great opportunity to come here, and I don't want to let people down. And whether I feel great or I feel a little bit crappy that day, I know I have to show up. And so that helps me try to stay consistent with the other things that make me feel good, because when you go in, you don't feel your best, it's a tough day. And so I like to try to stay as consistent as I can and keep that routine as consistent as possible. But I would say for people that sometimes struggle with that consistency, you know, think of your why. And I think that's going to be the thing that drives you, you know, if you're not feeling your best, to still show up.
Yeah, that's great. I agree. That's something that we talk about here at Super Athletes. It's like idea. We call it emotional stamina, but like the worse you feel, the more you do with the stuff that, you know, that works well for you.
Yeah.
So what you're talking about there of just having that routine and still showing up and executing that routine.
Absolutely.
Is a huge piece. And then I just think the adversity thing is so interesting because so much of, you look at like Division I football, like you want to face the best teams in the country. You want to get that opportunity. You want to see how you stack up. Mm-hmm. So why can't we bring that same mentality and that same mindset to, you know, whatever else life throws at us?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's a good way to prepare these kids for, you know, post football life. A lot of them aren't going to go to the NFL. And I think giving them some of these tools and strategies, obviously we hope it helps us win football games. And like you said, be the best that we can. But I think, you know, we look at it realistically, the big proportion of the kids on the roster aren't going to go on to the NFL. Mm-hmm. And so can they take these things to be successful humans after they leave the U and they move on from playing football? And I think a lot of the things that we do, both on the mindset side that Coach Feld really has that, like I said, a big emphasis on, and then the things that we do across the athletics department, we hope that those skill sets that they're learning with us can be used as non-athletes when they graduate from the U, and the things that we're teaching them can help them be not only better humans, but healthy humans. And I think coming from that athletics background, a lot of people are broken when they leave sport, and that balance of health and performance is really, really, there's a big dichotomy there. Mm. And so most high performing athletes aren't necessarily the healthiest. Mm-hmm. And so those things that we're trying to teach them now, hopefully they can take, and once they graduate and move on, they can be healthy. And a lot of this isn't really, I think it kind of covers the entire spectrum of, you know, the general population to the most elite athlete. And I think that's, again, where we try to just, you know, keep it simple with our messaging as we can. And then, education really driving that, you know, this is helpful for you. This is what you need. You might play the same position as this guy, but you have two different needs. And these are the whys on the things that we're giving you. Mm-hmm. These are why we're giving him these things, because you guys are two different guys and you guys have two different needs. And that's hopefully what they can start to take with them when they leave.
And then what are a couple things with let's say football, that in terms of tools that have you found, like, okay, these are the most important things for guys to be doing, whether that's in the limited time they have in the weight room or in the off season, that is your department has decided that this has had the has the biggest impact.
Yeah, that's a good one. I think this one may be a little bit controversial. I think aerobic training.
Interesting.
Well, that's a big one. I think because the sport is so anaerobic from a, you know, a performance perspective, when you're watching the game, you know, that generally tends to be kind of the emphasis when it comes to practicing and team conditioning and lifting and different things like that. In that kind of that aerobic aspect often gets a little bit neglected.
Mm.
So I think that's a big piece. It can, for us, it does two things. It helps with the recovery for sure, and gives that a aerobic base for them to do those anaerobic activities and do them at a high level consistently for a longer period of time. But two, based off of our local environment, aerobic training can really create a lot of adaptation as it relates to heat sensitivity and training in the heat. And so we want to be able to give our guys that foundation to handle the heat load that they experience here in Miami, but then also have that ability to be as highly anaerobic as they need to, and then to recover very quickly and do it again. So for me, aerobic training is one of those things that I think is really, really massively overlooked in football. And we're trying to do a good job of that here at the U. And then two, I think just general soft tissue and mobility management. Mm-hmm. For our guys, because everyone wants to be very explosive and they need to be durable, and you know, collisions are violent in football, but because they're so young and they can, a lot of them haven't had a, you know, an extensive training background until they get to us, really emphasizing mobility, soft tissue quality, and how that is going to enhance their lift or make them run faster or be more durable when it comes to the collisions. Those are kind of two of the things that we are spending a lot of time emphasizing with our group right now.
That's really interesting. Okay, so there's the higher our aerobic capacity, the better our body responds to heat. That's what the data shows.
There's definitely literature that supports the premise of having a very good aerobic base or more aerobic capacity allows for better assimilation to training in the heat. And for us, that also, I think, speeds up the recovery process, not only on the day of competition, but the days after competition. And so that compounding effect of the load that they live in becomes a little bit less impactful on them as far as recovering and being ready to go the next day. So we see that big compounding effect day to day. And really where we see that impact is week to week. So if we can improve that, I think we reduce that delta as it relates to that burnout effect that we get with guys. And so for me, aerobic training, and again, because it doesn't look like aerobic need is part of the sport, mm-hmm. it gets overlooked a little bit, but where our staff's done a great job is kind of like, what do we need to do? What can we do to get better? And I think with the data that we've collected over the last 2 years, we've seen that is a really important factor for us.
And then how are you guys training aerobic? Are you guys having them on a bike? Are you doing 300s or?
That's a good question. We do a little bit of everything, right?
Okay.
We're trying to figure out ways to, you know, in some ways keep them off their feet and, mm-hmm. and build aerobic capacity that way, just purely to reduce some of that load of the ground contacts. So assault bikes, different rides that I've had experience with in the NHL, mm-hmm. have been really useful, especially with our return to play guys that might not be able to run yet. And so we've seen a really good impact with some of those tests and rides that we've done. And then just, you know, changing some of the actual running to be a little bit more paced out runs for tempo and or time, as opposed to just running, you know, 100s, 200s, 300s, and just giving it a set time. Because when you're running against your peers, you know, your skills combos are running against each other, and you know, your bigs are running, they always want to be the first guy, right? Because they're mm-hmm. going to look slow. Mm-hmm. And so you kind of get into that anaerobic zone because they're running too fast. Mm-hmm. And so when we change it from being just from here to there, and we give it a time, we can actually pace them a little bit better. Mm-hmm. So those are some strategies that we're using for aerobic training, and, you know, different things like ropes and medicine balls, and, you know, just changing the stimulus, carrying heavy sandbags, whatever we can do to get that training effect without, you know, pushing them into that anaerobic zone and really creating a, you know, sympathetic burnout effect that we've seen over the last couple of years.
Yeah, that is really interesting, because there's so many coaches who say, well, you train like you play your sport, And it depends, right? There's like, there's
for sure.
Yeah.
I think there's times for it.
Of right? course. Like of you, course. Yeah. I think of course.
At different parts of the year, you have to train for the sport and you have to train like the sport. But there's different times of the year where you have the opportunity to offset that and enhance certain qualities that you just don't have the ability to, or you shouldn't do at a other part of the year. And so when you get into that kind of, I guess, more periodization of what you're doing type of conversation, you really have to emphasize, you know, the why again of, you know, when you come out here, coach, and you see us and they don't look like they're running that fast, it's not because they're loafing. It's because we intentionally are trying to build up a certain quality.
Yeah.
And so really emphasizing why we're doing what we're doing and how it's going to help us when it comes to football practice. I think those have been really critical conversations. And for us, one of the I think for me specifically, where I've gotten a lot of buy-in with our head coach has been on the temperature load management, you know, traditionally people think that, you know, playing in the heat and living here is going to be a competitive advantage for us. You know, but when we practice at 10 a.m. and it's hot and humid and the solar radiation is at its highest point of the day for us, and then we play at nighttime, it's not the same thing. So you really have to look at, all right, are we getting the actual effect that we want from that on the adaptation side, or are we getting too much burnout where our practices actually get, you know, a lower quality output from the players because of that effect? And so where we've done a good job with our coaches explaining that concept to him, and then utilizing our facilities, we have an IPF, an indoor practice facility that's unbelievable, that my first year here we rarely used. This year we used it, you know, at least 70% of the day, and our bulk of our practice was indoors, and then maybe our last team period might have gone outdoors or the period right before that. And so really did a good job, you know, just managing that heat load with our guys this year. And I think that had a big impact on our, not necessarily our outcomes of the game, but the ability for our players to feel their best for four quarters for 12 games this year.
And then what was getting taxed that you were seeing in terms of practicing out in the heat every day in the morning that players were feeling it?
So one of the sensors within the Tiger Tech device is it's a temperature sensor, and it's within 1 degree of a Schwanzgen's catheter. So that Schwanzgen's catheter is, if you're having surgery, it's a way for your surgeons to measure your internal temperature. And so we know that when we see these athletes living at 102 degrees or above, that they're at a higher risk for heat injury. And if they don't get a heat injury, you have a big, I call it a delta in your burnout rate, but it's gets very, very quick to create a sympathetic burnout response because of the heat and the training stimulus that they're experiencing. So for us, really looking at time under excessive temperatures, and then looking at different things that we can correlate performance metrics to, like velocity, how much yardage over certain velocities that they were accomplishing, and do we see a point of diminishing returns where over a certain temperature we got slower. That impacts what the coach sees. And when you say, if we're spending too much time at these temperature ranges, we're going to get slower. Cut it off. We're going inside them. And so, you know, tying those kind of internal or those health metrics to the performance side, and really saying, if we do this, you're not going to have great performances. If you do this, you're going to have better performances, was really how we kind of started to get some traction on that. And I think another piece for us, just on, you know, that general populations can kind of take away from this, is that with a lot of our kids, they might be on ADD meds, and they might be taking some of those things to help them with, you know, their schooling and so on. But because those are amphetamines, they're going to create a sensitivity to heat regardless. So with a lot of those kids, we already had a level of heat sensitivity that as soon as they went outside, they spiked to 101. And so we need to monitor them very closely so that we were reducing heat injuries with those athletes because of the circumstances that they were taking, you know, with them taking their meds. So that was another way that we were able to kind of push this load or a heat load management concept, not only across the performance side, but with our medical staff.
And then, not to geek out too much on this temperature stuff, but that was something that was kind of like a storyline with the professional team here, the Miami Dolphins. And it's like, when playoff time comes, they're unable to perform in the cold. which of course is just a great, you know, media storyline. Right. And if there's a million different factors, but my question is, do you feel like there are things that can be done to prepare a team down here to go one time to play, you know, negative 10 degrees or something like that? Is there things that can be done physiologically?
You know, I'm sure there are. I would say that I don't know the answer specifically to that. I think that's a tough one, because you often do see the same effect on the cold side as you do with the heat, right? Mm-hmm. I think sometimes the heat, you know, oftentimes it might be a little bit faster that you see some of this deterioration, let's say with an athlete running, right? They get tired, they look hot, and where with the cold, it might take a little longer. You might see a little bit of that, you know, the dexterity go first. And then some of the cognitive side, they seem confused, and that's where you become hypothermic. And I think so, you know, when you look at the hyper and the hypothermic responses, they're very similar. One's easier to kind of maintain, I think, you know, like in the heat, if we go inside, or we have cooling breaks, or we have these opportunities to teach athletes, you know, your face, your hands, and your feet are going to be the easiest things to cool. So here's things that you can do. So we have, I think, mitigation strategies within the heat load environment that's easier than the cold. I think, you know, our IPF, I think, only goes down to 60. So when we were going to Boston College, we turned it to 60, but it was like when we got to Boston College, you know, it was like almost 30 degrees. It was nothing we were going to do to change that. So I think going to the cold, it might be a little bit harder to kind of give some of those, you know, maybe changes to what they're doing. I don't know. It's a tough one. But I do think there is some evidence that suggests that the hyper and the hypothermic responses really impact the nervous system, and specifically that sympathetic burnout. And I just don't know what you could do to make it cold enough. Like, like, you know, with the Dolphins experience going to KC, that's a tough one.
And then what are you most excited about in terms of the performance industry that you see coming up in the next 10 years?
Athlete specific, I think really getting better at understanding concussion and traumatic brain injury. I think that's a big one. I think that's a big one for the Department of Defense as well, mitigating some of these concussion-like symptoms from discharging firearms and breaching and you know, different things like that. And I think just with the various technologies that are becoming available and some of the research that's coming out with looking at eye biomarkers and the, you know, some of these internal like heart rate and HRV biomarkers, as well as blood biomarkers internally, can we see whether an athlete, for example, you know, when they're out with a concussion, is this an actual traumatic brain injury, or is it a symptomatic concussion where the cervical muscles may have shut off and they're creating that effect of a concussion? So looking at certain things like, do the biomarkers of the eye change? Do the internal biomarkers like HRV and heart rate change? Do your blood biomarkers change? If not, it may be more of a symptomatic concussion of a cervical injury and not a traumatic brain injury, where with certain, you know, direct traumatic brain injuries, a lot of that might be, you know, eye biomarkers change, blood biomarkers change. We know that there's a physiological impact, whereas on the other it might not be. And so these subconcussive events that these athletes have or that these operators have, can we mitigate the severity of an actual traumatic brain injury? I think that's something that we're very excited about. I think it just impacts the population across the board. But those are areas I think where technologies are starting to evolve.
That's amazing.
And I think that's where, you know, for me, over the next 10 years, that's going to be a very exciting area of sports sciences.
And is there anything in the fitness and performance industry that you don't like where it's headed, or something that stands out to you? Maybe you question it a little bit.
I don't know. I mean, there's always something.
Yeah.
I think being too reliant on technology is a problem. And I'm saying this from general populations to an elite athlete standpoint. You know, when you're too reliant on technology, it could be a problem. And especially with interpreting that information and then making a game plan to impact something, you know, it should be there to give insight and, you know, maybe address certain things that you can see or you can feel and maybe get a little bit of feedback on. But if you're reliant on that to drive your decision making, I think it becomes a problem. And, you know, I think it should be used to inform, you know, both ends of the spectrum, general pop and athletes.
Yeah, we did a podcast on that a few weeks ago. I said, when I get a real janky score on my Oura Ring, I'll just cross it out.
Yeah.
And then I'll put something different on there. Because
right.
It's, you know, again, it's finding that balance of getting rituals and routines and scaffolding in place so you can perform at a high level. But then also, you know, shit happens. Yeah. So, Oura, what are you going to do about it?
Right. Yeah, I think that's probably my biggest, the biggest thing I don't like
is
just being too reliant on tech and you know, I'm going to do this today because my Whoop says or my Oura says this.
Yeah. Yeah. That's awesome. Okay. Rapid fire to end this, Eric. Biggest mentor in your life?
Roger Takahashi. He's the former head strength coach of the Vancouver Canucks. Yeah. He was, you know, from a professional standpoint, you know, incredible. It really helped shape me as a professional, just down to the trust that he put in me when he brought me to Vancouver. You know, really, really incredible mentor of mine from a professional standpoint. I think my dad, just personally, you know, what he sacrificed for us growing up and, you know, the opportunities that we had, and the, you know, the constant support that he gave us going through school, really, I think on the personal side would be my dad. And, you know, I think, learning from them as you know, said helped me as a man and as a father. So I think, you know, those two would be my biggest mentors.
Wow, that's amazing. And then best book or research paper that you read in the last year?
Thinking in Bets by Annie Duke. I like that one because a lot of what we do is, you know, there's a term called resulting. And when you put a suggestion in place, you make a plan, a lot of you know, what happens in sport is, did that plan work because we won, or did that plan work and we lost, so now the plan doesn't work? So really looking at how you can, you know, make better decisions and thinking in ways where probabilities are going to be the best driver for making that outcome a successful outcome. I think that's been a good book for us. And, you know, instead of doing something the right way and then scrapping it because we lost the game, I don't think that's the best strategy. And so that's been a helpful book to kind of like, you know, improve my communications in ways where it's like, okay, yes, we didn't win, but the players are fresher. And, you know, in 3 weeks from now, it'll benefit us that we, you know, chose to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. I want to check that out. Because it's so easy to get caught up with what the result was, and then, you know, but is that really what caused the result?
Exactly. I think that, and I actually came across that book originally because I was, you know, used to play poker a lot, and I love poker, and so she's a former pro poker player. So I picked it up because I thought it was gonna be more poker based, and then, you know, I was like, oh man, I can use this at work.
Yeah. And then the habit that has had the biggest impact on your life that you've either added or taken away in the past year?
Not drinking as much beer.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, at first it was a little bit of a, you know, negative impact.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, it's been a positive. You know, I like to have a pop here and there, but I think reducing the time between having those beers has been beneficial for me.
That's awesome. And then last one, you got some beautiful artwork on your arms. Most meaningful tattoo that you have on your body?
I have my wife and my kids' names on my arms. So I think those are probably my most meaningful. Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Well, Eric, thank you so much for coming on Super Athlete Radio. Now, we know that you're in the depths of Division I sports and within that confines of that arena. But if anybody wants to reach out to you, what's the best way for them to connect?
I'm on Twitter mostly, for social media. I think that's at Eric Renahan, or email at eric.renahan@miami.edu.
Awesome. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you.